Beets are a great source of nitric oxide, and you can get the benefits of 3 whole beets in just 1 teaspoon of Super Beets without the beet taste. No fuss, no muss. It's a great way to get your nitric oxide in your bloodstream elevated. Call 800-738-2198 or go to intelligentbeets.com. That's 800-738-2198. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Today's guest, Dr. Gerard Mullen, he's author of a great new book entitled The Gut Balance Revolution, and a revolution it is indeed, because the information is coming fast and furious about the importance of the microbiome. 5 years ago, you couldn't get arrested talking about that. Nobody knew what you're talking about. Now it's all the buzz. And the implications of microbiome research include the possibility that the right kind of diet can help you lose weight, not just simply via caloric restriction, but by modifying your microbiome. That's one of the main themes within the Gut Balance Revolution. You can find out more information at the great website of Dr. Mullen, which is thefoodmd.com. And Jerry, we're talking in part one about some of the ramifications of the microbiome on health. And we can't have this discussion without talking about, you know, what do we do in this culture, in Western society and in our modern world to disrupt the microbiome? And chief among those things is our reliance on antibiotics. What are the potential effects of antibiotics?
Well, really excellent point. In today's society, there's probably numerous things that disrupt the biome. I would say, besides the Western diet that we can talk about, The principal, I would say, stealth cause is the antibiotics. And the reason why I say stealth is the fact that we are getting antibiotics exposed to us without us even taking antibiotics. Okay? And let me just first explain what that means. So unless you're a strict vegetarian and you're not eating chicken, you're not having any kind of livestock, is that you know back in the 40s, that they started giving antibiotics to cattle to prevent certain infectious diseases that were contagious amongst cattle. And well, all and behold, you see that these cattle start growing at really fast rates. And someone made the observation is that if you want a fat cattle, before they got into the giving them hormones, is they start giving them antibiotics. So they kind of teased out the science and found it's because you're shifting the microbiome. But what we're finding out now through this great science I'd mentioned over the last 5 years is that it's adversely shifting the biome into a fat-forming type of microbiome. So what happens is that the antibiotics that are shifting this mix into a dysbiotic mix, and that their ecosystem is actually holding on to more weight, absorbing more fat, and actually metabolizing those fibers into more and more calories and absorbing more calories from those fibers, is that they're making the cattle fat. But the problem is the antibiotic stays in your system, is in actually the meat. And so with Dr. Marty Blaser, who you may have had on.
So excuse me, it's amazing that we've known this for decades. Farmers and livestock producers have used this principle for decades. It took 3 or 4 decades or more for people to recognize that what's true for animals is also true for people. We dose people liberally with antibiotics from virtually infancy to old age. And yet we've not recognized that it might have the same consequences as it does in cows, pigs, and chickens.
Well, the story gets a little bit even thicker, or the plot thickens, in the fact that even the USDA recognizes that it can be in milk. And so they test for it every year. They do kind of random spot checks. And they did a little bit of a spin saying that, you know, maybe 90% or so of the people in the spot check were compliant, but 10% were not. And those 10%, the levels were profound. And they were large distributors. So it kind of like, you know, it was a nice spin job, but we're getting antibiotics in our milk too.
Okay. Yeah.
But back to meat. So what's happening is that Dr. Blaser, who you may know from New York.
Yeah, actually, we've actually had him on talking about his excellent book, the book on antibiotics. Yeah, he's at NYU, and he's got a whole department which is now looking into the effects of the microbiome. He's not an integrative physician, but he's a concerned physician. And later in his career, he recognized that this trend towards excessive reliance on antibiotics may not be a good thing.
Well, I'll tell you what study he did, and then I'll tell you how I hooked up with him. So what he did, and him and Dr. Cho, who works in his lab, is give mice the level of antibiotics that is found in our meat.
Like tiny amounts.
Once a day?
Yeah, tiny amounts.
Tiny amounts, and he made them fat.
Whoa.
With only the amount of antibiotics that is found in red meat at a standard, consumption, not someone who does supersize me every day. And what they found, I thought it was maybe two to three servings a week, something, standard, and made those mice fat.
Wow.
And gave them like an insulin-type metabolism, and they called it a stat model, is that they were able to reproduce obesity just by giving the red meat that has the antibiotic. Now, there's other models, when we talk about the Western diet, that you can induce obesity in mice just by giving the Western diet and give the same type of bad bacterial pattern that we see in people get antibiotics and gets all other causes that we see associated with obesity. So we know it's on the biome. We know the antibiotics are disruptive. I mean, just as you mentioned, the pediatric studies, that it's clearly correlated that the more doses of antibiotics you get before you're 18, the better the predictor that you're going to become obese later on. The science is solid.
Yeah.
So in this regard.
And what is also scary, and I read this recently, is that, we now process a lot of sewage in this country. And so they have these, these demonstrations where people in the sewage plant can literally, hold a glass under a spigot and, pour some decontaminated water and just drink it down because it's completely decontaminated. Or so they say. There's no bacteria, there's no chemicals, supposedly. But what they found is that it's very hard to eradicate antibiotic residues from the water. And moreover, the processing changes the antibiotics into novel antibiotics that create a pattern of bacterial resistance that is, way ahead of the curve of even what we're seeing in hospitals. And we're doing this population-wide. So I found that extremely scary.
So what I define, and I agree with you on that, and I find it be very interesting, is that the reason why antibiotics became into the conversation was not because of the linkage with obesity. You and I, and like-minded folks, see it that way. The government calls it superbugs and C. difficile, which is at epidemic proportions and very difficult to treat, and antibiotic shortages. So the government's taking a very different view. It's kind of like, well, we need antibiotics. We're not denying that, but we can't run out of them. For some reason, there's shortages. And when we give them, and we give too much of them, and we all recognize that, we create more C. difficile, which is deadly. So this new era of superbugs, resistant bugs, that is where these meat producers say, oh, okay, so 80% of antibiotics are used in livestock. We're having shortages. We're having superbugs. The feds really want us to cut down on them. Now we're going to spin around and say, okay, company X, I won't say who, is going to say, we don't use antibiotics in our meat.
Right. We see that all the time. More and more people are making that declaration. The eggs are antibiotic-free, cage-free, antibiotic-free, whatever. Yeah.
You'd be surprised that the fast food restaurants are now following that mantra.
Yeah.
Right? Like they're healthy. But I'm just saying is that, but it's for a different reason. It's not because they're admitting they're making us all fat. It's
right.
Because, we got to prevent C. difficile, and that's what's going on here. But they all know, basically, that has really created the culture of illness in this country.
Right.
By and large.
They're not fundamentally going away from the culture of using antibiotics. They're just saying we need to keep our powder dry, don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes kind of approach, you know, where we're restrained about using antibiotics. But they're all four powerful antibiotics ultimately. And frankly, you know, antibiotics save lives. But, you know, we now have new discoveries that common infections like what we used to think, remember in medical school, they said, well, if the pus is yellow, if the mucus is yellow, always use antibiotics. If you have sinusitis, bronchitis, otitis, well, then you really need an antibiotic. If you have a cold, okay, no problem. It's a virus. But now we recognize that many of these conditions are self-limited. They'll go away in 10 days without antibiotics or a week and a half with antibiotics. It's about, it's the same. So
overprescribed in children, Ron. There's children who have viral otitis media who are getting antibiotics.
Yep.
That's how our kids are getting sick, and that's why their immune systems are getting wiped out. They're underdeveloped. They're getting autoimmune disease and asthma later on. We're becoming, we're a Purell nation. When we're all wearing, with the sanitizers, it's like we've gone the other way. You know, with this hygiene hypothesis fits this whole model.
Yes, and that, we're in our germ-free environments, we're creating people with weakened immune systems and more susceptible to allergies and autoimmune disease. So to switch gears slightly, the Gut Balance Revolution, you tackle what you call the calorie myth. What do you mean by the calorie myth?
Mm-hmm. This is a very nice segue from what we just discussed about a calorie is not a calorie, because the law of thermodynamics is kind of energy in, energy out. I was a chem major, took pre-chem and did all that, and, knew how to calculate
the laws of thermodynamics. You know, we all learned that in college, right?
Well, that is true, but what's happening is that you put a calorie in somebody, it will equal the amount of calories going in you and the calories coming out. But the problem is you can't say in an apple is 35 calories, and therefore you are absorbing every single big 35 calorie. That's not true, because there is fiber in that apple, and depending on the health of your microbiome, if you have a very fat-forming microbiome that's not biodiverse, you may get every bit of that 35 calorie, because those bugs become really very fertile in terms of really fermenting those fibers into what they call short-chain fatty acids, which are very energy-rich, and you will absorb those. So, but if you have a very normal, healthy, balanced bacteria, maybe you'll absorb 30 of those calories. You follow?
Yep,
so when
sure.
you measure the energy of the stool coming out, when you have the fat-forming bad bacterial mix in the colon, you're going to only have very few calories coming out of the stool. But if you have a normal balance of bacteria, you're going to have more energy coming out in the stool. Less will get absorbed. Less will be broken down.
So this really is a refinement of the expression a calorie is not a calorie is not a calorie. I mean, like, obviously calories from pure sugar or high fructose corn syrup are more deleterious than calories, say, from a carrot. Okay, we know this. The glycemic index and so on. It's the way that it hits your body. It's time release. The fiber, somewhat attenuates its absorption. But what you're saying is that it's also influenced by the individual who's consuming the calories because of what's in their gut, that is actually an important
right.
mediator of the effect of the calories, and may explain why there's a differential. Some people, and they're not lying, they say, I don't understand it. I'm really dieting. I'm very careful. And they're, sometimes doctors disparage people like this. Oh, you're cheating. Well, no, they're not. They just can't seem to turn off the calorie absorption mechanism in their gut.
Well, let me put just like a little bit of a mechanism together for you in the audience. That'll just take a minute. And so what's happening is that we have this Western diet. And the Western diet is a highly glycemic, highly refined, high saturated fat diet that really does, in scientific studies, turn the microbiome into a very dysbiotic fat-forming mix. Okay? It's highly glycemic. It's highly inflammatory, because when you have that dysbiosis, those bacteria are starting to break down the lining of your gut, making them very leaky and very porous. Their toxins are being now disseminated systemically, causing a pro-inflammatory response that inflammation makes you insulin resistant, hyperglycemic, and turns on the fat-forming mechanisms of your body. So when we talk about a pro-inflammatory diet, it's these highly refined, sugary, fatty, fast food-oriented, red meat-oriented diets that turns your microbiome into a mess. Then your microbiome is messy, breaks down your gut, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's the diet that makes the microbiome bad. Then it's the microbiome who takes the diet, hyperabsorbs the lipid, hyperferments the little fiber that you're eating, and turns that into more calories that are more pro-inflammatory and makes them transform into fat. And then you get a vicious cycle. And that's how that's the dance we're talking about here with the bad microbiome, antibiotics, you know, whatever else we could talk about in the environment, obesogens, and then you have the bad food coming in. It is a perfect storm.
Well, let's mention one other factor, and you're a gastroenterologist, and your profession, present company excluded, is guilty of creating an epidemic of use of this particular medication, which is extremely deleterious to the microbiome, and you know what I'm talking about. We're talking about PPIs, a whole new raft of medications which are introduced with great fanfare 15, 20 years ago because they were the ultimate acid blockers. You know, when I was in medical school, we used to do I was studying surgery. They used to take people's stomachs out because they couldn't shut off the acidity. It was a common surgery, a gastrectomy. They would just take the whole stomach out because people were developing ulcers. Now, no more. You know, surgeons no longer have to do that. Instead, they're doing gastric bypasses because people are obese. They manage to diversify. But what does a PPI do to the microbiome? And many people are told, look, you can stay on them for life. In fact, you're supposed to because otherwise you might develop cancer from your Barrett's esophagus or your stomach ulcer.
Well, here's the thing. PPIs, and there's been several meta-analyses on PPIs and small bowel overgrowth, and in the majority of the PPI meta-analyses I've seen, there have been positive that there's an association. So we know that these PPIs very likely will certainly block the acid, and you need the acid to keep the upper part of the digestive system, you know, clear of bacteria or overgrowth of bacteria. And the body, at least the upper part of the small bowel, doesn't like to have overgrowth of bacteria. And when it does, it starts to break down the lining. So that association, I don't think there's been association with obesity yet. I don't know if anyone has looked at that or not. It may be difficult to do, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. And people are relegated to a lifetime of being on these medications. We do it very casually. And, all too often, it's a matter of lifestyle. It's a matter of changing diet, which is, you know, much more difficult than handing a patient a prescription. But I think this is another thing that we have to push back against is the tendency for doctors to prescribe and patients to willingly accept PPI prescriptions, not just for a few weeks while an ulcer heals, but for a lifetime of supposed protection. So it's not really good for you.
I agree.
Yeah, I wanted to move on to another myth that you seek to demolish. It's on thefoodmd.com. By the way, some excellent blogs there and lots of useful information. The exercise myth. You're not a big fan of exercising like crazy to burn off the calories.
You know, that's a very good point. Here's let me give you like another minute overview of that. I think movement is good. I think exercise to get people not sitting down and sedentary, cardiovascular benefits of exercise, build up a little bit of, you know, body mass in terms of muscle. Lean body mass is good, but what happens is that people to the point of breaking down their bodies and structure with exercise, and what happens is that for some people, appetite will go up. If they exercise too much, it'll break down your gut barrier. We see that in marathon runners. We see that in people who overexercise. There's even colitis people get from ischemia. But the problem is, and we didn't talk about dieting in general, like people who overexercise, is that if you starve yourself and think that you can just deprive yourself of calories and you lose weight that way, what's going to happen is that not only is your appetite going to go up, right? There's an adaptive response called the set point. And that set point is going to shift. So as the more you starve yourself, your metabolism goes down, and it's harder and harder to lose weight the more you starve yourself. And that, and even trying to exercise in the same vein. So, you know, some people can be successful at the diet and exercise venue, but the vast majority can't sustain that. And if all you do in that format, unless you're very strategic in building up your lean body mass as you eat smartly, is that people tend to break down muscle mass in the process by over-exercising and doing cardio, under-eating. You're going to break down your fat-metabolizing muscle. You're going to have more of an appetite. You're going to yo-yo, and then your set point's going to raise, and you're going to actually gain more weight on a rebound. It's a vicious cycle.
And you're going to enrich the sports medicine doctors who seem to be proliferating in every major metropolitan area of the country because I think the poster boy for that proposition was Secretary of State Kerry, who at the age of 72, after bilateral hip replacements, was pedaling up the Alps and conked out and, like me, you know, at a younger age, broke his femur, which is, you know, one of the downsides of perhaps overzealous exercising. All right. So in a couple of minutes that we have, you know, where do you see this going? Because you're an outlier among gastroenterologists. Do you see hope in your profession? Because all too often gastroenterologists are doctors who scope patients. They have a few primitive tools to deal with gastrointestinal problems. They have the, you know, aforementioned PPI medications. They have a few medications that reduce spasm in the gastrointestinal tract. Do you think that some of these findings are going to make their way into your local gastroenterologist's office and they'll become more aware of the relationship between the microbiome and overall health?
Well, that's a very good question. And not that I am a mind reader or a fortune teller. What I see happening now is that there are champions of diet and nutrition out there, and I think more doctors are actually acknowledging the fact that having patients on a proper diet is an important part of the plan. And that may sound shocking to you to hear, but there's been, in the GI world, there's certainly champions of the FODMAP diet and others that champion the fact that diet is really part of our plan, even though doctors aren't always comfortable handling that. They acknowledge the fact that that's really essential, particularly with irritable bowel, inflammatory bowel disease, so on and so forth. In terms of, let's say, nutraceuticals, I think there's been a push for peppermint oil. I've seen more and more articles on it, people acknowledging that it's got a, you know, virtually no toxicity and has an efficacy in many respects that really outpaces virtually all of the IBS medications. So I think that from that point of view, people also are really against herbs, and they harp on the hepatotoxicity. There's a lot of articles on that. So, you know, the data is kind of mixed in terms of where people stand in terms of complementary therapies. There's many pioneering type of gastroenterologists out there who are integrative in many different aspects of their care. And they're promoting yoga and meditation and stress reduction and diet. And I think those people, because of the position I'm in and writing that, you know, editing that book for Andy Weil, I hear from people, I see people, I receive emails, so on and so forth, is that I'm aware that people are really coming out of the closet in that respect. And I'm finding the younger physicians are the ones that are, it's more part of their culture or their upbringing from their parents that are really impacting on them to really move forward. In fact, there is national boards of nutrition physicians. That's Dr. Melina Giampolis, who's a CNN correspondent, has now become the president of within the last year. And she's really promoting the practice of nutrition in physicians, because physicians really kind of gave up ownership of that years ago. And we have 80,000 dietitians who are out there as championing nutrition, but doctors, certainly those who are educated, really should be, you know, as well be visible promoters of this. And Dr. Molina is one who's really championed that and trying to bring it back into the mainstream. So keep your eye on her as well.
Well, great. Perhaps that's a future interview.
Yes.
Look, I want to acknowledge your pioneering work in this area, and you know, you really have given this field a tremendous amount of credibility by lending your expertise to these concepts, which I think really are necessary when we're taking a look at GI health. So the new book, today's call to action, is The Gut Balance Revolution, which is available now as of, when is it released?
June 9th, Tuesday.
Oh, great. Okay, so, you know, so very fortuitous, and I think you can pre-order on the website, thefoodmd.com. I recommend it very highly. And once again, keep up the great work and keep getting the word out about integrative gastroenterology. Today's guest, Dr. Gerard Mullen. Thanks for joining us, Jerry.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Okay. Really enjoyed talking to you. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.